Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs with Sibel Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins, and today we're going to talk with John Young about his website, cryptome.org. I'll spell that for you, CryptoMe.org. John Young, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Give us your own description of the purpose, the mission of your website.
It was set up in 1996 to publish documents that the government would prefer that not reach the public. And so it's primarily a repository of documents, some 54,000 of them right at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's its purpose, was to put up documents, let people read them, make up their own mind about them.
And what's your own background, and do you have a day job to support this habit?
Yeah, I'm an architect in practice in New York City, have been for many years, and so my firm supports this activity.
And was there a triggering event of some information that you felt should be made public, and you were frustrated because of the layers of bureaucracy or false claims of secrecy or confidentiality?
It was a meeting of some wonderful people on a mail list called Cypherpunks in 1994, made up of engineers, scientists, and technologists, who had, most of whom had some affiliation with the dark side of our government. And they knew that some of these dark side technologies were going to come to the market because of the wind down of the Cold War, including they were going to be out of work. So they decided to start letting this information come out, knowing that it was going to be used against the public. And so they decided to start releasing documents they had access to before they lost their job. We set up a site to make those documents available. The first was dealt with encryption and then moved into communication security and from there into espionage and other matters.
And we've had a couple of administrations since you started this work, first a Democrat and then a Republican for 8 years and now a Democrat. Do you notice any difference in the free flow of information as administrations change in Washington?
Not much. One of the peculiar things about government is they love secrecy, whoever they are. They may campaign against it, but once they get inside and they get their briefing, including non-disclosure agreements and that some people call drinking the Kool-Aid of national security, they never want to go back again, partly because they can't go back. Once they're told this stuff, they can never talk to the public about it. And so it's an interesting hook that takes place with these national security briefings. So whether they wanted to do this or not, if they're going to get in on it, they've got to swear to be part of the secret-keeping crowd.
Have you ever had a clearance, a security clearance of any kind?
No.
Would you want one? Do you want to be briefed into the black side?
Good question. I don't think anyone's posed that to me before.
Yeah?
I'd have to think about that. But before the show's over, I'll give you an answer.
Okay, great. Why don't you take a moment here and tell us about a recent episode where Microsoft contacted your web hosting service with a takedown order because you had posted some information. It's right here on my screen right now, the Microsoft Windows 7 Spying Guide.
Well, it was a slightly earlier version. The one that you just mentioned is one we put up after this incident.
Okay.
But the first one was a guide to law enforcement explaining to how to understand the data they would be getting from Microsoft, how to read it, how to find identifying information of users of these stuff. And so it was a kind of a hand-holding showing law enforcement who are not terribly adept at getting into the underbelly of Microsoft's product, showing them how to use it and to spy on the users of the product. We thought that would be worth putting in the public domain, even though it was copyrighted, so we put it up.
Mm-hmm. And what was the reaction from Microsoft? They have a whole security department there of people, I guess, who crawl the web looking for what they would consider breaches in their security or confidentiality.
That's correct. They have a, we understand, several dozen, maybe hundreds of people prowling the Internet looking for copyright violations. And why they do that is there's a very simple procedure under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to just send a notice to the Internet service provider that mm-hmm. there's a violation, and that automatically kicks in a notice to the person who's hosting the document. There's no going to court. There's no hiring of lawyers. It's an automatic process. And so that's what they invoked. And that was done in order to get immediate action against copyright violators. That's what the DMCA is, and there's no appeal from it.
Mm-hmm. And they can order just on the basis of an allegation.
That's correct.
Your host, your web server host, has no choice but to take you down for a minimum of 2 weeks.
Well, is they give you a notice and give you 2 days to take it down or else. And that's the purpose of this, is to get fast action and to give you what we call a draconian warning. You either do it or your site's going to be taken down. And so we challenged that notice and said, we will not take it down. Let's see what happens. And so they took the site down.
And in that 48-hour period, you were able to disperse that same information and set up what are called mirror sites. Explain that and the methods that you take to protect the work that you're doing against what you would consider to be inappropriate interference.
Our site has had several mirrors or copies of it being run around the world. That's one of the defenses we set up. And so that those sites take from our site every day whatever's put up new and keep those sites active. So those are always up. This particular document, which we put up shrewdly just before the weekend, got thousands of downloads before Microsoft noticed it. And so that the document was widely available, and they finally picked up on it and sent the notice out several days after we first posted it. And other people were then starting to offer it. Wired and other journals were starting to offer it as well. But actually, the real publicity didn't kick in until our site was taken down. That's what created the furor.
Mm-hmm. And explain the sequence of events that followed and how you were able to reinstate your site.
Well, we didn't do anything. What happened was that various media outlets started covering the story, and it got some traction. And lo and behold, about 36 hours after it was taken down, we got a notice from our service provider saying that Microsoft had lifted the violation and they were going to restore the site.
Mm-hmm.
We were taken aback. We were prepared to go to court because the complainant, Microsoft, would have to go to court as a next step within 2 weeks, or at least file a lawsuit against us, or the site would go back up automatically. So those steps are all spelled out in this so-called DMCA.
Mm-hmm.
So we were expecting to go to court, and we'd like to go to court with Microsoft to raise this issue. We think that these corporations are bluffing a lot of people into taking down documents, and it's just a bluff. So we call the bluff.
And are you lawyered up? Do you have, say, some pro bono attorneys who will support your efforts?
No. In fact, we've been told by attorneys, don't do what you're doing, John.
That's the usual, right.
But you must be aware of this. And so they said, however, if you do, we're here waiting for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't ask for legal advice anymore. We put it up and see what happens, and then we'll decide what to do. Because so many legal challenges are bluffs. No one wants to spend money on lawyers. And so that if they don't have to, they won't.
Now, I have a question here, because when it comes to the government, you have a different story, and that is government has all the resources they need in terms of the attorneys. They can put 5 attorneys, 10 attorneys, and drag it in court. And what would you do then if you're dealing with the government coming and trying to take action against you?
Well, we're looking forward to that. What we'll do depends on how they come at it. We've had several visits from the FBI.
Right.
Politely asking us to think about what we're doing, although they're quick to say nothing you're doing is illegal, therefore this is just a friendly visit, they call it. And we've never been able to get any documentation about what happened as a result of those visits, trying FOIAs all over the place. So they've been by, they've called, but nothing from in the way of a court action. So we've never had to go to court. We're waiting for it, looking forward to it. We'd love to go to court. We've gone to court with other people, but to back them up, but we've not been taken yet.
So
by the way, that's the bluff, that we're going to take you to court. Now, lawyers will do that. I mean, government lawyers will do that because they love to go to court.
Right.
That's what they're paid to do. And so, so far, though, we don't have anything that is litigable. Is that a word?
It works for me.
No, but that's interesting because the story that we hear from many people in the mainstream media, even the alternative media, is, well, if they know, if they have gotten a document, you know, by a witness or a whistleblower that has some stamp on it, say, classified, and if they see that and if they publish it, they will get in trouble. And because of that, they, you know, their editors won't let them publish because the attorneys for these newspapers, publications, they won't let them publish. So does that make sense then?
Well, of course, but it's a crock. That is just not true. That's just the story they put out. Is that we know that, in fact, most of the large media are complicit with government and pretending that they're in opposition when, in fact, they're not. We know that most leaks is done by government, not by individuals or whistleblowers. The government leaks to advance their interest, and the press goes along with that. They, too, publish orchestrated leaks in order to advance their interest.
Right.
And so that both are authoritative, in which we're opposed to anyone that's authoritative or any institution that's authoritative, not opposed to authorities, but authoritative people, whether they're in government, institutions, whatever. So that one of the things that authoritatives do is they protect their privilege of being authoritative by pretending that we're in opposition to each other. And it turns out it's just not true. They're actually in cahoots with each other. They mirror each other's behavior. That's why we just put up documents without vetting them or saying they're okay or whatever. We say, readers, you decide. We put them up. This is raw data. You decide what to make of it. So we don't pretend to claim something is classified or not classified. We put it up and say, do what you like.
And, John, that's one of the things that I was struck by at your site, and that is that this is really just a bare-bones list of documents with a, you know, pretty limited, what do you got, room for maybe 45 or 50 characters for a title or description.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no editorial. There's no point of view that you offer that, wow, this is a smoking gun or, you know, this is a sizzler. You simply provide the information and leave it to your readers to evaluate it and make their own views or decisions.
That's exactly what we're trying to do. In fact, our model is a library rather than a blog or a whistleblower site or whatever. It's just a library, and it has all kinds of non-controversial stuff there. Periodically, we get controversial stuff, but we don't say it's controversial. That's for other people to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy for us to do. We don't have to stop and think. In fact, we try not to think too much. So we put stuff up and see what happens.
Now, what other kind of risky behavior do you get involved in? Do you ride a motorcycle without a helmet or jump out of airplanes with only one parachute?
Well, I live in New York City.
Well, and by your accent, it doesn't sound like you're a native.
Well, that's even worse. This kind of accent in New York City means that I'm a target. And so it's interesting, but I feel the same way toward them. Yeah, I'm from Texas. You know, the saying down there, one problem, one ranger. So one New York City, one guy.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I'm getting off the point, but the thing is I think that not fitting in is an important part of doing this kind of thing. If you want to be part of an approving crowd, you probably won't be doing this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're probably familiar with a gentleman from my part of the country here, Mark Klein, who was working for AT&T.
I am.
And he became aware of the secret room on Folsom Street in San Francisco, where the NSA installed a digital switch. It's actually a fiber optic switch. That essentially created a parallel stream of all of the telephone and internet traffic that was going through this massive switch site.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know exactly where that data stream goes because it went down through a hole in the floor to a secret room below. But we do suspect that it's very much a part of the illegal wiretapping program that was launched under the Bush administration and to some extent legalized by the 2008 FISA reforms. I still maintain that it's a deep violation of our Fourth Amendment rights, but we're unable to test that because they keep the cases out of court through a game of cat and mouse. First, they say that plaintiffs don't have standing because they can't actually prove that they were wiretapped. And then they say that you can't sue because of the immunities that were granted to the phone companies, which I find questionable in terms of legality, constitutionality. And finally, they will assert state secret privilege, saying that exposure of what is obvious would compromise national security and sources and methods. Tell me your thoughts about the Klein case and the courage that Mark showed in publishing this information despite the various setbacks that he encountered along the way.
Well, I'm not quite sure how we reward people of his courage, but they need to be rewarded. Probably be given a Medal of Freedom, like the president does, that they should be given more than just notoriety. They should be given a lifetime pension or whatever they want. Give them whatever they want. Because otherwise, what's the point of doing this if you don't get something from it? Now, of course, Mark is a wonderful guy, and most whistleblowers don't expect much reward. So God bless him. So the more credit we can give them, the better. I do think that he went as far as he could, and the hole in the floor is an interesting one. We don't know for sure if this was a fake operation or a real one. We do know that there is similar things going on at every one of the data farms around the world right now, and there are dozens of them and more being built all the time, these huge collections of servers of the Internet. And so that it is so easy to tap information from the digital world, much easier than in the wired world. And so that's all they got to do is just plug in a cable, and they get the whole thing. And since these companies are paid to allow this to happen, it's very lucrative business as well. And so that the digital system is the easiest spy mechanism that's ever been invented. And so one of the things I know about the spy people, though, they're always setting up fake operations to divert attention from what they're really doing.
Now, I'd never thought of that. That's interesting.
They do it all the time. It's standard tradecraft, they call it. And if the public pays a lot of attention, they say, got them. Got a huge success. Now, please don't anyone possibly tell them what we're doing down in St. Louis or Virginia or in the Virgin Islands. Let them hang around San Francisco, because there that's a seed bed of government opposition, so let's just dangle something in front of them. Now, I only say this because it's standard operating procedure to do this. And including fighting in court is now a standard diversion to tie people up in court, thinking they're making great headway by squeezing data out of that. But right now we know that's an orchestrated process, too. And you only know that by studying all these cases over and over and over and seeing how many times it happens and how artful they are at dragging stuff out. But meanwhile, they want to capture the public's attention to keep them away from the more interesting stuff. So we gradually learn a few lessons from these operations. And by watching the technology now, I only know this because of this first group that I mentioned, cypherpunks. These were the people running these systems. And they know how this stuff really works, not how the lawyers and financiers and the PR people talk. They actually know how it works, and they talked about this early on. And they say that they laughed about how easy it is to deceive people about what technology does and its capabilities. And periodically we'll get these folks to come into public. Mostly they just keep out of the limelight because they don't want to be drawn into this public charade of fighting. And by the way, they definitely don't like the legal financial approach to this. As they say, these guys are totally insulting toward technologists and impossible to get them to listen. Of course, they don't understand anyhow. Nonetheless, I think Mark is right to call attention to this, and we start with our little thread, and we pull it, and we eventually get through that hole in the floor, and we'll find out if there's anything down there at all or not, or if that was just a little diversion.
Sibel?
Yes. How about, in general, national security whistleblowers? We have been dealing with this area for many, many years, and as we started experiencing firsthand and then later on through our activities with the Congress, we realized that there is really no government channels for whistleblowers that's worth going through, because, again, those are diversions too. And in fact, once you go through those channels, you end up getting even more stuck in this web that they have put in place to basically trap you. And these are the employees with the clearance, you know, NSA and FBI and CIA and so on and so forth. Then our advice to whistleblowers or whistleblower wannabes turned into be this one line. Disclose it. Make the information public. Don't go through the channel. Well, of course, it's easier said than done, because when it comes to doing this, they feel like, and these are whistleblowers or people who have not blown the whistle, but they want to disclose information that they believe is important to be public. And I agree with you. All information, almost all information, should be public. Government information, and the whole secrecy is just doesn't make sense, and it just challenges the both democracy, oversight, accountability, everything. But the point is, once they are in this position, whistleblowers or wannabe whistleblowers, and they make that decision that, okay, they want to disclose certain information, they want to go somewhere or be able to send that information to someone that they perceive trustworthy, that so that information can, you know, become public. Now, some of these people, you may say, should just go ahead, and there are so many ways to do that now that we have the internet, and they can safely do that. A lot of these people, they have been, you know, for years in this fear climate, this fearfulness of, you know, no, I won't do that. They're going to come after me. I have clearance. They can jail me. And as you said, it's mainly bluffing, because last time they really went after a whistleblower was with Dan Ellsberg. I mean, truly going after whistleblowers, and even that didn't work. But somehow there is this fear, even though they don't have any cases, examples to say, well, to point to and say, well, this is what's going to happen to me. The government has been able to contain them, many of these people, just through fear factor. But they want to know what is the best channel, what is the best way to take an information and make it public. And because you've been doing this for a long time, what would be your advice to these whistleblowers from the national security-related agencies?
Well, is to look for a site that will provide an air gap of security. That it's true that if they put up their own site, they'll be traced. So they do need a cutout, or not a firewall, but I'd say an air gap, such that it would be difficult to find out who provided this to a source, say if it's Cryptome or you or someone, which means you got to test that source, though, because there are many honeypots out there.
Exactly.
I mean, these are very tricky, deceptive people who will set up a fake site like Cryptome to invite people to come in. So you do need to test the water before you decide to go whole hog. Now, that's what they do on their side. So you send a document in, you leak one, and see how it's handled. Be patient and see if you get burned. But do one that where the penalty will be light before you go whole hog. And do not give it to an anonymous site. You've got to test the reputation of who's putting this out. Do not give it to a mainstream site. They're too complicit and they're too afraid of losing their own market, which are the established authorities.
Right.
And so you've got to run some risk with some of the, if you will, offbeat sites, but expect to be tricked. Now, all these folks, of course, who are in the secret world know about this. They know because they're briefed on all these tricks that people will do to get information out of you. And one of them is to set up a so-called fake site to get you to talk with them. And it turns out it's probably run by your own agency to see if you'll fall for that. So, but listen, they're all trained to handle that kind of thing. So they actually know better about how to protect information and themselves than you and I do, Sybil, because they're trained to do that. So one of the things that I don't worry about is being hoodwinked. I did in the early days because I thought my reputation might suffer if I did something stupid. But now I don't worry about that anymore. I expect to be tricked. But I tell our readers, I'm going to be tricked. Don't trust our site. Make up your own mind. Don't think anyone is an authoritative source. So I would say that to a whistleblower or a leaker. Put your stuff out there with some care. And recognize that at any point, even a reputable site, say if I had a good reputation, which I don't, I hope, I can be turned at any time into something that I'm not. And that's done as well. Now, however, those are stories that are told by their security people. We will trick you into believing a site and then use it to burn you. Now, I didn't know all this 15 years ago. I didn't know they were that. I didn't know they were so mean. But, of course, they say this is what we do. This is our business. However, I'll say simple, since we get nothing that's classified, except at least from the U.S., we get it from other countries, we don't have the experience you've had. We've never had access to truly classified stuff. And we don't expect people to send us classified stuff. We're too unknown. And they wouldn't trust us. They would probably think that we're some kind of a con job. So, but I will say this, I think the whistleblowers and leakers should have an air gap of some kind. Don't be stupid and go out there and put yourself up and sacrifice yourself and your family without doing some very careful checking. But, you know, I'm preaching to the choir. They know all this.
But I will say this finally.
I'll close off my rant. I know there are fake whistleblowers out there because that is used to contaminate the stream and to put some crazies out as whistleblowers. They're paid to be crazy. They're paid to be conspiracy theorists. And so what they're trying to do is to make you distrust whistleblowers. Now, that, too, is standard tradecraft. And it's just part of the business that they're in.
That's a very interesting point. We have been naming those people. We have titled those people, those whistleblowers, as the false flag operators.
Mm-hmm.
And we have had experience with that. In fact, several examples of that just happened through National Security Whistleblower Coalition when we were forming, and I'm sure maybe there are others that we have not been able to identify, but we came across a case that involved a pretty well-known FBI whistleblower who wanted to join the organization, and he actually did. And later on, we had other contacts in the agency who disclosed to us that this person actually was a false flag operator, and he was reporting directly to the FBI's headquarters. And in fact, we even got photos of this person going to Quantico for certain briefing.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't made this public, but we made it public to the new employer for this well-known FBI whistleblower, who happens to be a civil liberties-related organization, and they just took no action. As simple as that. So we don't even know what's the deal with this very famous organization that is civil liberties-related.
Well, but anything you've got on that you'd like to put in the public domain, because I think the only answer to this kind of thing is to publicize everything that you know about that, about these shenanigans, rather than the alternative.
Right.
Because what they count on is that that there's nothing you can do about this, but there's answers to these plants.
And
one is to get people to pay attention to how you can recognize them. By the way, these are not always the smartest people in the world. I'm sorry to say, I'm not a smart person either, but I'm saying it's amazing how bumbling they are. People in authority are unbelievable bumblers, as you know, Sybil. And they make mistakes, and they think that they'll be able to get out of it just by invoking authority. That's about all they've got to fall back on.
Now, how about the question of dissemination? And let's say when you have a whistleblower or whistleblowers or anonymous whistleblowers who disclose actually, or they are able to somehow put out there some, you know, information that is backed, supported, and then we see that nothing happens. Sure, you have thousands of websites downloading it, but the media, they don't touch it. Completely blackout on the issue. So you still have, 98% of the people, let's say, in the country, in the U.S., they are not aware of it. They don't know. And a lot of whistleblowers, they get to this point, they say, well, it ends up being a waste. And just what good did it do? What would you tell them?
Well, I tell them that you've got to be persistent, that you should not fret too much that the media is not picking up. Say, don't expect that. One is they get thousands of submissions all the time from people who claim this is urgent information and you've got to help me get it out. Be patient, work your way through multiple sources, and stick with it. It may take several years to actually get it noticed because there's so much coming in. And by the way, a lot of that volume is put out by authorities to cloud the issue. They like to choke the system and put out all sorts of stuff. Now, I've been told this by journalists, says we know that these agencies send us crap to try to get us to bite, and we just don't. And so even they recognize that they can be fed stuff by the authorities to clog the system. So I think that we've been around long enough now to know that you don't get success easily. You've got to keep working at it. And so I think that but one of the things you cannot get immediate big media attention. It's just too hard, and you've got to build a base to support that. They won't go out on a limb for you. We small people will, and we can feed the bottom layer until there starts to be some kind of traction for it, and then it might get mentioned. But even then, it may not. It may take some incident like this Microsoft thing with us is unusual. We typically do go for months or years with no real attention. And frankly, we never know what's going to get caught, what's going to catch on.
John, when you talk about government-based or official-based misleading, misdirection, it brings up echoes for me. I recently posted on my website at peterbcollins.com a lengthy interview with an attorney from Chicago named Jeffrey Haas. He was the man who, pardon me, who represented Fred Hampton. Mm-hmm. And then when Hampton was killed by the Chicago police with the collusion of the FBI as part of the COINTEL program, it took over 11 years to force the government to disclose that they had a paid informant there and to disclose the memoranda that were issued by J. Edgar Hoover to prevent the rise of a new black messiah and to break up these black nationalist groups using almost any available means, including illegal means, including, in this case, the murder of a man who was innocent and who hadn't even been investigated or charged. And so there is a history of this. This is not a new development.
That's right.
But it has probably taken on new skins in the digital age.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about what you have seen in terms of the way government uses misdirection in the false whistleblowers and the phony websites that you were referring to a couple of minutes ago.
Well, I'll give you just a couple of words about my background. I've been doing this kind of anti-authoritative work ever since I graduated from college, so it's now over 40 years. And so this started long before we got on the Internet, and so we learned a lot about these undercover operations by government because we were constantly dealing with undercover informants in our community work, which is perfectly innocent stuff. It's just that they kept tabs on everything. Even if you weren't doing anything, they wanted tabs on it in case you might do something in the future. So this kind of pervasive domestic spying has been going on throughout my experience. So coming onto the Internet, it just makes sense that they'll do it here. They will go anywhere that people are gathering and communicating. They will do this. And so it's a standard operating procedure to do this, including putting people in your organization, often in the leadership positions. And so I'm extrapolating from that into the Internet, and it helps me understand how some of these operations work here. And so that's the background that I'm speaking from. It's not just what's happening on the Internet, which is merely a extension of what's happening in the rest of the society.
And John, we have seen in a series of alleged domestic terror investigations and prosecutions, the Stockton Lodi Mosque case here in California, the losers in Florida, who have now been to trial twice for an alleged, an alleged attempt to blow up the Sears Tower. And in each case, there has been a paid FBI informant who is not just there to monitor activities and report potential criminal behavior, but was actually provoking it, providing ideas. In the case in Florida, this FBI informant led his followers in a loyalty oath to Osama bin Laden. And then he talked about getting uniforms as if terrorists, you know, wear uniforms and have a military command structure. And yet we see the government, proceeds nonetheless to try to convict these people using the enhanced enforcement abilities that they have under the Patriot Act, the charges of conspiracy and of, being aware of terrorism without reporting it. And so I'd just like to know your thoughts about that, because, again, going back to the Black Panther infiltration, the informant in Chicago who drew the floor plan of the apartment that was raided and permitted the police to kill Fred Hampton and Mark Clark without killing Hampton's pregnant girlfriend, who was sleeping in the same bed with him, is quite remarkable. And it turns out that this guy's name was William O'Neill, and he joined the Panthers and became their local director of security. At one point, he was building an electric chair that he said he would use on any people who squealed or leaked out of the Black Panthers, and he also had a mortar or some other a device like that that he said he was going to use to attack City Hall in Chicago. And again, this was the guy who was on the FBI payroll and reporting to his minders on a regular basis.
Yes, absolutely. And this is not unusual. I think that we have kind of a blurry vision of how security people operate, whether it's military, intelligence, or police. I think that we have a kind of a glorified version. This is not unusual for them to do, and they see nothing wrong with it. They think it's an absolutely useful tool to do this. But they seem to convince the public that it's a good thing, too, that our enemy fights dirty, we've got to fight dirty. We're doing it because they do it. They actually have no scruples about doing this. And so, in one sense, one shouldn't be surprised, because you see it over and over and over, and so that it's kind of like, if you don't know this, where have you been? On the other hand, often people really don't care about this stuff until they are told to care about it. Now, that's the burden that all whistleblowers have, which is that there's such a culture of stigmatizing whistleblowers as being dishonest, self-interested, ego-driven, a maverick, a nut, that you've got to recognize that's going to come with the territory. If you try to do anything like this, you're going to track flies. And these flies are these informants, because they're... undercover operations is the glory side of government. They actually pay people more to do this. And so that it is where people go who have a strong ambition to work out of sight of the public.
And I haven't talked about this before, but one person who appears to listen to the Boiling Frogs podcast on a regular basis contacted me in December of last year. And I haven't kept track, but easily more than 400 emails have been sent by this person to me, along with some information that he mailed to my post office box. And none of this was solicited on my part. He wants to be interviewed on the program. And his story is, he claims that there was an attempt to recruit him into the CIA, and that when he declined, that they began to harass him. And he reports that there are vehicles that look like government operatives who follow him all the time, that his email and telephone calls are monitored at all times. And frankly, he came on so strong that it set off alarm bells to me that this seems so over the top that even if it's true, he presents as a paranoid individual, and it would be very hard for me to discern what's real and what's not. And I'm just curious, if you get this kind of behavior where people barrage you with information, and some of it's credible, some of it he's just... forwarding emails from other websites that are reliable and do have valid information. But my overall reaction is, this is too much to be believed, not too good to be true, but just that, my bullshit detector goes off.
Yeah, well, I'll just say, in our early days, we got swamped with people, not over the top, but very learned people who asked us to meet in an out-of-the-way park, and they had a cache of documents about Kennedy's assassination or about Hitler or God knows what. So we said, great, this is what we want to see. So we went to look at all this, and that was our freshman year in learning to do this stuff. Very artful, engaging, polite people. Some of them seemed to be well-to-do folks. And we also get the type that you're talking about. And you gradually start to get a sense of what you do and do want to do. However, what we did, we put everything up. And people throw up, reject, send their own stuff in. Only because we don't feel comfortable knowing for sure that that we're so smart that we know who's right and who's wrong. Don't forget, the most bizarre people in the world are spies. And they cook up more conspiracy theories than anyone else except the Catholic Church. and all the other religious people. So the notion that these little people cooking up their scare stories is doing something weird or crazy, then you haven't looked at the institutional version of that. FBI is completely insane as an organization, but then so is the CIA and all these secret keepers. They're nuts. They've cut themselves off from society, and they only live within their own alternate reality. So I say, let these other folks have a voice. Let them come out. Because, as psychiatrists say, it is the cult of secrecy that breeds this paranoia in people. It's not their fault they're fancying the CIA is following us. The CIA, promulgates that kind of stuff. And because they're the holy church of secrecy, of course it makes people paranoid. That's a healthy reaction to the cult of secrecy. And so the best way to respond to that is say, well, it turns out all these so-called nuts sound more rational than the president's daily brief.
Very true.
And we have to keep that in mind, is that the conspiracy theories is the lifeblood of the national security establishment. The enemies are everywhere. The FBI wouldn't have a job if they didn't have conspiracy theories. And they're very good at it. They have a vast subcontractor cult cooking up stories all the time. It's very lucrative business to cook up stories. Of course, the media gets involved, too. By the way, I love the media. I love to read their fanciful versions of reality. And so I say, fine, let's get it all out there. But don't act like you're the authoritative source of this because you hold an office here somewhere. I'm saying, no, actually, it's people like that that lie and cheat the most. And people who know these institutions from the inside know that's true. The question is, how do you get it out? Because if you get too close to the truth, they'll come at you. You bet they will. And the gentleman in Chicago, listen, I served in the military. They don't look at human life the way the rest of us do. They do not mind collateral damage. In fact, as one military guy said in an op-ed in New York, if you don't have collateral damage, you're not having a real fight. Too bad, civilians. You got to die because there's a war on. Get used to it. Now, talk about merciless insanity. Now, this guy wrote this op-ed, and the Times published it. So I'll just say is that I don't mind publishing these folks' stuff. Now, it turns out I don't know which ones to publish and which ones not. But I tell you, if you've got a forum, you're going to get it.
One of the issues we are facing, we have been facing, is this balance between wanting to increase the, informed citizenry. But on the other hand, one of the things we get to see a lot, especially lately, is this desensitization, that people are bombarded, especially now with the internet, with so much information, including, the good ones, the bad ones. And the more they get to know, it seems that they are getting more used to it and developing, the lack of apathy. I don't know how to describe it other than this really uniform mass desensitization. So first, a lot of people were saying, well, because people, they don't know, we need to give them this. I mean, just one example of it is the torture, the pictures. The initial story came out and we had the outrage, with Abu Ghraib, and then more information, and then it got to be hundreds of pictures came out, and less outrage, actually. And later they said, well, there were 2,000-3,000 more, and they were thinking of releasing it maybe, and then they decided that they... But just the fact that there were thousands of more of these pictures of these actions, torture being around, and after the initial shock and outrage, the topic, the issue of torture, ended up becoming one of those, oh, yeah, well, that's how it is. And you don't see people pounding on torture anymore. I mean, this even includes the activists, many activists and organizations. It is a given situation. This is just one example, and we see it over and over and over. I mean, not many people talk about the NSA's illegal wiretapping anymore. It was an outrage, and then it became a fact. It became fact. So there is also this negative side that, you're like, well, we need to put this out. People have to know about this. But then when you see the results, the more they know about it, the more desensitized they're becoming, and then it becomes a fact of life.
Well, it is an interesting technique, and again, don't think I'm the author of this. It's what I've been told. There is a technique of using a shallow version to cover up a deeper version.
Yeah.
And so that is that's a PR campaign. See if they'll buy this story. If they do, we don't go any deeper. Or we'll peel another layer off and stop there. But don't ever go all the way, and certainly don't go all the way at first. So you gradually release stuff. Now, that's how the FOIA program is being used to deceive us. And so one of the things that will happen is they will count on the public becoming tired of a story if it's not very interesting. This is just repetitious. So they count on that wearing you down. So that's why I say you've got to be patient, stay with it, watch for that, look for new ways to come back at it, and be persistent, as the lawyer said about the Black Panther case. Don't forget, these folks are in it for the long haul, and they will take a 30-year time frame to work on their side and expect you to get tired, move on, get a job, commit suicide. And so you got to stick with it. And I don't want to sound jaded or cynical. I'm saying, no, I like to stick with it myself. I like to stay with it and see the various permutations. Because don't forget, they also get sick, commit suicide, die, go to jail, And so it's not like they're completely impervious, but they will pretend to be that way. And you just got to be kind of dogged. And by the way, I think most people are dogged. And so it's not as though these folks have access to some ability that we don't have. That's just a pretense they give, like, we know everything about you. But, you know, we started hearing that as kids from our parents and from our church and from our teachers. We were always being told, we know better than you. And then you gradually say, hey, I'm the parent now. I actually know better than you do. And so that, since I've been around on Earth for a while, actually some of these stories by people 20 years younger than me, I don't know if you know how silly you sound, Sonny, in saying stuff like that. You know, these FBI just come around, they're younger than my children. And they're expected to see some young, wild-eyed hacker doing this stuff. They come into my Upper West Side apartment, and I look like their father, actually. And so they actually do a double take. And so I think the old salts have got to do more, as well as the young salts. I think the old salts have got to get off their ass and do more based on their experience. And, you know, some of them do. Some of them actually leave their jobs and go off and get a conscience and come out with stuff. That's what I count on, that they won't be afraid of losing their job anymore, and they'll start to spill the beans. Because most of us are controlled through our money source, through our economic thing. And, of course, I can do things on my website I could never do as an architect.
I'm glad you mentioned this very important point, because I almost forgot about it. You said Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, FOIA. And I'm amazed to see how many people, and these people, whether in the media or even the attorney's offices and many nonprofit organizations who are active in the civil liberties area, they consider this a very important and valuable vehicle to go and get information. And while in reality, if you look how FOIA works and what you get and what you really don't get, It is one of those channels where the government can truly handpick and cherry pick and give you what they want you to have. Yet there is it has become one of those very highly valued and emphasized channels. What do you think of FOIA?
Well, I think it's nonsense that
right.
People who are getting stuff through FOIA are overvaluing it and making much of it, because it gets so little. Yet they have nothing else to work with, so they act like it's a big deal. And yet they actually don't get much. Now, the National Security Archive gets some good stuff, but a lot of the other stuff that comes out through FOIA is not much. But if that's all you got, then you mark up 200% in terms of its value. I know I've not heard anyone critique FOIA the way I'm saying it, that it's a con job and that you're not going to get very much that way. Then you have to go to court, and that means lawyer expenses, and then even then you don't get much. But everyone pretends that it's a hard struggle to get it. And I'm saying, no, that's a phony struggle. It'd be better if you broke into the office and got it. I mean, if you really wanted something, or you wait for one of these honorable leakers to give you stuff and walk out with it. FOIA, and we've done a lot. You never get very much. But then people say, well, you got to go to court to get the good stuff. And I say, look, the whole purpose of FOIA is not to have to go to court. That's actually another hurdle. Then you got the lawyers to deal with and pay. And they don't usually get very much either, but then they will always explain to you why not. And we got to go another 6 years to work on this. And it's something of a flim-flam thing now.
Spent
so it needs to be revised.
And now,
there are people who are saying it's totally corrupt and ineffective, and it needs to be changed.
Say that again, Sibel.
I spent 5 years, my attorneys, and it was, I mean, they really believed it to be so valuable. 5 years in court and close to $70,000 chasing FOIA and then going to appeal. If the law is there and you request it and they have whatever 20 business days to respond, and if they don't, the burden is on you. You have to go as a citizen, get the attorneys, go to court, and start paying that $300-$350 per hour to fight it in court, and they can drag it.
Yep.
They can drag it for years and years.
Well, you know, that FOIA processing has become a huge cash cow for the government.
Absolutely.
They've hired thousands of attorneys to work on this, and they want more. They want us to file more, but they want us to go to court or to have more FOIA personnel where they can drag it out. It's an interesting process. And, of course, it's because there's a little belief system that somehow this is a good thing. Well, it was in its early days, but not anymore. There has to be a better method. It's not working. In fact, as Secrecy News points out, the amount of stuff that's being classified has grown dramatically since FOIA was passed. It hasn't diminished. It's gotten worse.
And, John, you mentioned, and what we're talking about right now, is the way they will deliver partial information as a way of obscuring the much more significant info that is behind it.
That's right.
Nixon, back in the Watergate era, released those volumes, those binders, filled with transcripts of the White House tapes, and he famously referred to it as the limited hangout route.
Yep.
Which is to, you know, give them something to distract them from what's really going on.
Yep. Yep.
And I'm one of those crazy people who does not believe the official story of what happened on 9/11. And I personally went to Washington and spent quite a bit of time watching the activities of the 9/11 Commission. And it was insulting and infuriating because they were determined not to uncover many significant issues or explore some of the most pressing questions that had been put before them. And I came up with a different analogy or metaphor, and that is of the ditch witch. And the ditch witch is this device you use to dig a ditch to lay pipe. And you can set it to go 2 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet, or 10 feet. And if the information is 10 feet down, well, the 9/11 Commission was set at maybe 6 feet, or maybe even just 2 feet. But it so far has held and worked pretty much to their advantage. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, because that's not an isolated example. There's
As a rule of thumb is, if you want to bury something, set up a commission.
Yep.
And that's what they do. They actually do not reveal. They hide. And all of them do. And even we students ran into that when there was a study of the so-called student uprising at Columbia. They set up a commission. They didn't come close to the truth. They didn't want to come close to the truth. They wanted to put out a story that was quite different from the truth, and they did it. And we couldn't believe that they were lying, but they lie. Commissions lie. Not the only ones, of course, but that's what commissions are for, is to lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you about a specific case, the Al-Haramain charity that was based in Oregon and that was investigated by the FBI. And their attorneys, and I've talked many times with John Eisenberg from Oakland, who represents the attorneys who represented Al-Haramain. And they came into possession of a document, apparently by mistake. The FBI somehow sent them a document, and because of all the secrecy, they're not allowed to describe it in detail. But suffice it to say that it did establish that this Al-Haramain group was illegally wiretapped by the government, I believe by the NSA in their case. And they had this document, and then they were ordered to surrender it.
Mm-hmm.
And they have told me that they did manage to, they don't use the term mirror, but they managed to dispatch copies either by fax or by snail mail or some means, so that they did have, outside of the country, a copy of this very important smoking gun document, and they still are having trouble. Judge Vaughn Walker here in District Court in San Francisco has been pretty courageous as a Republican appointee in confronting the government and saying that they really, you know, are playing a game, and that the plaintiffs have established that they not only have standing, but they can prove that they were wiretapped. And I'm curious if you have ever seen the document in question, or if it is available in some site that I'm not familiar with.
No, I haven't. I've heard about it and love to get my hands on it. Mm-hmm. in order to share it with our wonderful public. And one of the problems that, of course, lawyers have is that they can lose their right to practice law if they are caught doing this. I'm not. However, I mean, if I did that for an architectural document, I could be in deep doo-doo. One of the things that I can do with Krypton, lawyers can't do. I can reveal information. Since they're officers of the court, they're bound to obey laws.
Yeah.
In a way that maybe you, I, and Sybil are not. So we can do things. They cannot tell us to do that, but they've said, you can do that, John. I cannot.
Now, in closing, John, I'd like to ask you about something circling back to an earlier part of our conversation about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was used by Microsoft to kind of summarily charge you with a breach of confidentiality and order your web hosting service to take down your site. Is there anything else in that law that the general public isn't aware of that can be used in a pernicious way, in a one-sided, illegal way that doesn't permit you to assert your First Amendment rights to silence individuals or others who have important information?
Yeah, it turns out the Electronic Freedom Foundation has a whole initiative on this issue, and they make the case, they've gone to court several times, that the DMCA is using to censor people inappropriately, that they can have documents taken down or your site shut down on the basis of unproven copyright. They can just say, it is my firm belief that this person has violated my copyright. They don't have to prove it. They just have to state it. They don't have to go to court. And so they actually, that's why it's a bluff. And if people fall for it, then it works. That's what it's supposed to do, is intimidate people. And so that needs to be known, and that's why we were able to pull ourselves out of the muck in this case. And by the way, the EFF attorney wrote a legal defense of our posting this document, said that it was clearly in the public interest to post this document, and that both our service provider and Microsoft overreached and actually broke the law in what they did. So that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, people don't know the law, and so lawyers are great at bluffing. That's what they're paid to do.
But it sounds like you've trained yourself pretty well, at least in the law related to these issues.
Well, I learn on the fly, and, you know, you never learn as much as when you're under a little bit of pressure, so we have to do something to not get lazy.
Well, John, I want to thank you for joining us today. Is there anything you'd like to add as we close?
Well, I'd like to compliment Sybil on her struggle, and it's been a great one, and give her a medal or whatever is appropriate to people who go off on these incredibly strenuous and lonely struggles. I've not been through anything like that, and so I don't know if you're a religious person, Sybil, but God bless you for doing this, and you too, for doing this show and pursuing this stuff.
Greatly appreciate it, and I'm truly thankful, and I admire your approach and what you're doing, and you're setting a good example for people in overcoming fear, because that's one of the main reasons we are where we are today, the fear factor.
Yep, that's right.
John Young, Cryptome.org. Thank you for talking with us on The Boiling Frogs.
Well, thank you. Bye.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.